Hello, everyone. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles. This is your host, Valerie, and I am pleased and delighted to have my dear friend and colleague, Fiona Givens, here with me today. Hello, Fiona. How are you?
I am really well, Val, and delighted to be with you again.
We are having so much fun. If it's possible to have fun talking about crime and punishment and neuroscience and atonement, these are some thick, deep, robust topics that you and I love to talk about, huh, Fiona?
True. Absolutely.
Yes. So today we are on episode number 3 of a very robust 4-part series where we are tackling one of the more profound book chapters that I have ever read. And Fiona, would you go ahead and tell us the name of the book that we are referencing, this atonement book that's brand new out, and the name of your chapter, so just so that people can purchase this if they would like to after they hear us talk. Latter-day Perspectives on Atonement. And what's the name of the chapter itself, Fiona?
It's chapter 9, and it's entitled Atonement and Retributive Justice.
Okay, so Atonement and Retributive Justice. And I will confess, I almost have this entire article memorized because I have had to read it and study it so many times in preparation for this beautiful podcast series. And I couldn't be more delighted to have studied this enough so that hopefully what Fiona and I are doing is packaging this content in a way that is really digestible as you're going about your days and listening to podcasts. So let me go ahead, if I may, and just do a bit of an overview of what Fiona and I have talked about in the last 2 series. But I will encourage you actually to please go back and listen to these, because each of these episodes are at least an hour long a piece, and they have just so much beauty and richness in them. So don't take my word for it. Go back and listen to them. But in the meantime, let me go ahead and give a large sweeping overview of the whole series of what Fiona and I are going to be discussing, have discussed, and are going to discuss. Okay, I'm going to challenge myself to see if I can do this. What we are talking about is how atonement theologies have varied and have shifted and morphed since the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and how one branch of atonement theology that was created by the Romans and based on Roman law, how it made it across the Atlantic Ocean, came to North America, and has impacted the criminal justice system here in North America and specifically in the United States. What Fiona contends in this article is that the criminal justice system and atonement theory both need reform, because the criminal justice system is informed by an atonement theology that is based on our sinfulness rather than our human woundedness. And she props up all of her research and findings based on modern neuroscience. And then her final contention, which we are going to be talking about in episode 4 of this series, is how Latter-day Saint theology actually has the seeds of good, solid atonement theology, if only we are able to see these beautiful seeds and implement them in our teachings and in our religious spaces. Okay, Fiona, how did I do in putting this big, giant topic into a nutshell?
So much better than I could have.
All right. So in episode numbers 1 and 2, what Fiona and I talked about was the difference between the Eastern Church's atonement theology and the Western Church's atonement theology. In brief, the Eastern Church really got their atonement theology. It was founded in Greek philosophy, whereas the Western Church's atonement theology was founded in Roman law. And these moved to the North American continent, and we spent some time talking about the influence of John Calvin and how penal substitution theory and retributive justice theory impacted the way the criminal justice system was created. Now, today in our episode, what Fiona and I are going to actually talk about is we're going to go more deeply into current neuroscience and its findings on the nature of trauma and human woundedness, and how neuroscience is helping us recognize the need for reform, not only in atonement theology, but also in criminal justice ideologies, because we have come to recognize that we as human beings are not bad, and we are not sinful, but rather we are wounded. And through our woundedness, what we need is healing rather than punishment. Okay, so Anything you want to say as we get started, Fiona? I know this is a big topic.
No. That's absolutely great. I'm really glad we're starting with law and neuroscience. So that will, I think that's a really good place to start. And I happen to have that page up on my screen. So thank you.
Good. All right, great. So why don't we begin with something? I'm going to be riffing off of your article and many of the things that you say yourself and that you quote in this beautiful article or this book chapter. And I want to begin here with some words of Victor Hugo. These are some of the more beautiful words I feel like I've ever heard in my life. So I think this is a great place to start. He says this: "Can the man created good by God be rendered wicked by man? Can the soul be completely made over by fate and become evil, fate being evil? Is there not in every soul a first spark, a divine element, incorruptible in this world, immortal in the other, which good can develop, fan, ignite, and make to glow with splendor?" Close quote. Fiona, why did you choose to insert this particular quote in this section of your chapter where we're getting ready to talk about the need for reform in atonement theology, but also in reform of the criminal justice system?
Well, I love that book, Les Mis, by Victor Hugo anyway, and he has some really, really gorgeous things in it. But that particular quote, I think it was as a reminder to me as I was starting to write that section that this is how originally people thought of human beings. They came pure and good and beautiful. And I love Victor Hugo's theology, really, that they will stay that way despite all the vicissitudes of life. They will come back that way to God, which means that we are misunderstanding atonement, because the sort of general view of atonement is that we come to earth and we are lovely, and then we sin and we just keep sinning. And it's just sort of this painful thing that goes on and on through our lives. And then there's sort of an end time, and we are all judged and parceled into, we would call them, various kingdoms. And that's it. It's not particularly edifying. It's not very hopeful. And I can understand why people are very miserable in their lives. I mean, there's a lot that comes into our lives that is heartbreaking anyway. But then to add on top of that a theology that confirms the heartbreak, confirms your deepest fears that you will be separated from your family forever, or that you will be put in another place. It's diabolical, and the incredible pressure that puts on the heart, mind, and soul is almost untenable. I'm surprised that people actually survive their way through. I think it's because we grasp, don't we, deep down, no, it can't be all that bad. There's got to be some flash of good. And I saw that in Victor Hugo's writing, in particular, this section.
Thank you for that. I love Les Mis as well. And I want to just ask you to talk to us about when you were preparing or thinking about this, these big questions, and I know you love studying the atonement. When was it that you decided that you wanted to look at the comparison between a sinful churchgoer and a criminal in jail? So we got a sinner at church and a criminal at jail, and you started to compare these two cohorts of people. Talk us through, how did you come by those two as a comparison?
Well, it was interesting. I was reading in the Old Testament, which is never a very good place to read if one wants to be edified and uplifted. But there was this one particular line, and actually it's been rubbing me badly for many, many years, in which God turns to the spirit children. From our theology anyway, we are alive and present. And he turns to them and he's saying, upon the heads of the fathers will I place the sins of the third and fourth generation. And he's looking at us, and it's like, okay, this this God is diabolical. I mean, that his this idea of forgiveness is not going to happen if we're going to carry the sins of our children and then keep carrying them. So I had to wrestle with that for a very, very long time because I threw it out. That did not comport with what my idea of God is or should be. And then I was reading, actually, I was reading Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, actually. And this book had such an incredible influence on me. And he talked about the injuries that the people he was defending on death row, and some of their lives had been absolutely awful. Most of them had grown up on the streets with no parents, just surviving, you know, just to stay alive. And they came into their lives at such a deficit that there was nothing that really could go right for them because they were so incredibly vulnerable. So there were tricks, you know, they had to learn, you know, to get on. And one of them, I'm sure, involved stealing, and then, you know, one thing led to another, as I'm sure they were preyed upon by, you know, sort of the equivalent of warlords in the ghettos. But he recognized that. He recognized that the whole story did not start with the first crime. Their story started at the very beginning when they were born in these awful circumstances that would have traumatized anyone. And of course, it traumatized them. So it was the first time I was actually seeing, okay, Brian is not talking about sin. He's talking about trauma. And the various aspects of the trauma led to these most unfortunate consequences at the end. But was that really their fault? Yeah, they did not choose that life. They did not choose to be abandoned by their parents or beaten by their parents or prey of pedophiles. That goes on and on. And some broke. I think some people can stay out of that, but there are a few who broke. And these, the ones he is defending are the ones who broke. But what it struck me was the humanity he brought out, that each of these human beings had lives and they were beautiful in many aspects. And so that's where really they needed very good doctors. You know, they need very, very good therapists or very good they just needed somebody to help, and they didn't have those. So they were left alone, sort of fighting for their existence. And that's pretty shortly after reading that book, I was able to adapt that particular verse to, we are all born wounded. Understood that the third and fourth generations, trauma travels through generations. And then that made incredible sense to me. And then it was shortly after that when I just replaced the idea of sin and retribution or sin and suffering or sin and punishment with the idea of woundedness and healing. I think I must have been reading in the New Testament at that time anyway. But it occurred to me, I'm a bit of a slow thinker, but it suddenly occurred to me that all Christ was doing was healing. He was healing the mentally incapacitated, physically incapacitated, socially incapacitated. That's all he was doing. And so I think I'm not very good with muted or indefinable things. So when we got to the verse, you know, if you've seen me, you've seen my Father. And, you know, it's like, well, no, I haven't actually, because that person I'm seeing has nothing like you at all. He's wrathful and vengeful. He kills innocent Egyptian children. There's nothing. I don't see him healing in any way, shape or form. But then that's when I realized that his whole mission was to correct or perhaps preempt the idea that would grow in Christianity of God being a wrathful, vengeful God, which would dominate the Christian tradition, particularly in the West, for so many years.
Thank you so much. Okay, that's not unusual, but my mind is feeling blown right now. Fiona, I want us to just spend a second, double back and like talk a little bit about some of the things you just said. Bryan Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, is the book she's referencing. It's about an attorney who takes on a death row case and in the process has a sacred experience becoming educated about the life of death row criminals. And I'm loving that that was the book that touched you, because I am a big believer, Fiona, that we can find scripture everywhere. And that is, that's a book of scripture, right? And so what you're describing here, if I were to offer to you my thoughts and interpretations of what you're teaching me, is that you saw in this man nothing more than a wounded human being that is experiencing something perhaps more extreme than what one may experience at church who isn't on death row, but both of them came by their sins or their crimes. You can use those words interchangeably, because to me it's more a matter of degree than kind. And mm-hmm. So you learned through through reading this book that in each and every case, human beings come by their wounds, they come by their mistakes, they come by their crimes because of so many things that led up to those things that they don't have control over, that our degrees of freedom vary based on any number of experiences and backgrounds and misfortunes and family situations and poverty and lack of access. And because of that, you were able to see that the criminal justice system and the church both has a theology or an ideology that treats people as if they make mistakes and they are fully culpable of those mistakes and need to be punished for them. And your idea here that kind of sprung from this inspiration through reading the book and all of your other atonement theology is that, no, we as children of God have painful experiences, and one small step leads to another thing, which leads to another thing, which for many of us lead to minor sins, if you will, and to others lead to major crimes. But both of them come from a place of humanity and of woundedness. Now, let me just, before I have you jump in, I want to read a couple of quotes from your book, because they really do a good job of illustrating this very point. So this comes from Fiona's chapter, and here she's using some other scholars to talk about this very thing that she came to realize. She says this, well, she's quoting Shelley Rambo, who says, "Trauma is a universal condition that poses deep challenges to theology in terms of the radicality of suffering. It imposes the impossibility of professing Christian claims of God's presence and human goodness." Then Fiona goes on to say, "The increased understanding of the causes and effects of trauma should constitute a hermeneutical lens through which an alternative theological vision emerges, one of healing and redemption." Then Fiona, you go on to quote Bessel van der Kolk, who anybody in the psychology world knows to be one of the world's leading trauma experts, especially on developmental trauma or childhood trauma. And van der Kolk says this, "Trauma happens to us, our friends, our families, and our neighbors." Close quote. Van der Kolk argues that much of the behavior we see as deviant, unhealthy, or in any way disruptive or criminal can be traced back to trauma experienced by that person at some point in his or her life. And then Fiona goes on to quote a scholar by the name of Hart, who suggests that woundedness or trauma and not intentional aberrance is at the root of deviant behavior. And then here's a direct quote from Hart. And this is perhaps one of my favorite quotes in the article as it relates to trauma and woundedness. This is what he says. "The character of even the very worst among us is in part the product of external contingencies. Of somewhere in the history of every soul, there are moments when a better way was missed by mischance or by malign interventions from without or by disorders of mind within, rather than by intentional perversity on the soul's own part. No one can ever fulfill the criteria necessary justly to damn him or herself to perpetual misery. There is no such thing as perfect freedom in this life or perfect understanding. There are always extenuating circumstances. Close quote. So this is Fiona's growing body of evidence that atonement is about healing the wounded soul, not punishing the sinner, not demanding reparation, not demanding guilt or shame, but that we are all wounded and that there are always extenuating circumstances, whether that be someone who is called a criminal on death row or somebody who sits at church, at a Mormon church at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. We are all wounded and deserve mercy and deserve the opportunity to grow. What can you say, or what are your thoughts on that as I read some of these beautiful portions of your article and the scholars that you have infused in your work today, Fiona?
That was very beautiful. I think another thing we could add to the conversation is brain disease. That's been fairly recent. I think it was Sigmund Freud who at the end of World War I recognized that soldiers were coming home very ill, not physically, but spiritually and mentally. So this idea of trauma set in regards to soldiers in particular. We also have inconsistencies in our makeup. So for example, because of Freud and then other scientists who then started to think, well, maybe deviant behavior is caused by something incorrect, some system in the anatomy that is not working correctly. There's this great book, Law and Neuroscience, and there's a neuroscientist by the name of Keel, and he does magnetic resonance imaging. That's become quite popular. And he has been, so there's this chap, Brian Dugan is serving, I don't know if he's alive or dead now, two life sentences for a pair of murders he committed in the 1980s. And now was faced with the prospect of the death penalty for an earlier killing. So he goes in and does an fMRI of Dugan's brain. And he's been amassing data on men such as Dugan for about 16 years. The crimes are often impulsive, violent, committed in cold blood, and recorded without the slightest twinge of remorse. They are psychopaths. They are estimated to make up as much as 1% of the adult male population and 25% of the prisoners. To date, Keel has used fMRI to scan more than 1,000 inmates. He says that the brains of psychopaths tend to show distinct defects in the paralimbic system, a network of brain regions important for memory and regulating emotion. This has been huge for me. It's like I'm thinking that I think in the main, of course, these psychopathic killers should probably not be allowed into the public. But my thought is, could they not be placed in nicer places? You know, a bit like the European penal system where they have flat screen TVs and their own restroom areas, and you know, it's starting to sound a bit like a hotel. But if you are going to be living the rest of your life out of company, which they probably will have to when one is a psychopath, it's not as though there's any treatment, there's something wrong with the brain unless we can fix it, but that we can be kind and generous and at least afford them a living which at the end of their lives they feel is worth having lived. And then also in John Hinckley Jr., I think everybody remembers him. He was a gentleman who tried to assassinate President Reagan. And they did a scan. Lawyers presented a computed tomography x-ray scan of his head. And it showed slight brain shrinkage and abnormally large ventricles, indicating a mental defect. So he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. What I think is so disturbing for me at this particular instant is how vehemently the American Republic, I mean, the American population responded. It was like Germans call it Blutlust. They wanted him to die. They wanted him to be, preferably on a large screen, electrocuted, or however they did that in the 19, whenever that was. But that's what struck me, was how much the doctrine of Calvin and the theology of Calvin has still got such a grip on our hearts and our minds. And we as a church community have not escaped it. I was talking to a young friend of mine, and he was on his way somewhere. But anyway, some member of the church was going to be excommunicated. And it's like, I'm not sure that that doesn't have the same effect on a person as putting that person in prison does. The emotional and the psychological damage that will be done. And so for me, I think we've got to get rid of Calvin, that is for sure. We really do have to get rid of that man.
So as you were talking, Fiona, about the variations that they found on fMRIs amongst criminals, I noticed in your article, you mentioned that in some studies done of jail inmates, over 50% of prison and jail inmates in the U.S. have a diagnosed mental illness, a rate nearly five times greater than that of the general population, and that nearly one in five prison and jail inmates have a serious mental illness. Let's just stay with that for a minute, because I think that is an important point to consider when we're thinking about your desire for us to look at reform, not only in atonement theory, but also in criminal justice theory, because what we're seeing here is that our life experiences impact our bodies and our brains.
Mm-hmm.
And because our life's experiences hurt us, when we are hurt and then become wounders sometimes, or in other words, you know how the old adage, hurt people, the difference that you're trying to bring forward is that when we make mistakes, whether it be small mistakes that we call sins or large mistakes that criminals call that are considered criminal, it's because life has impacted us and life has impacted the nature of the brain. So let's just stick with neuroscience for a few minutes, if that's okay. And I'm going to I'll talk a little bit about that.
That would be lovely. Yes.
Okay. So Fiona is the expert in atonement theology. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I am at least passionate. I'm very passionate about neuroscience. And so let me just spend a second talking about what this means when we talk about a criminal that the vast majority of criminals have struggles with, or have their brains are compromised. There are three parts of the human brain. This is very grossly oversimplified, but just to keep it simple, there's the brain stem, which is responsible for regulating our body rhythms like sleep and wakefulness, hunger, thirst, fullness, warm, cold, things like that. And so those kind of things kind of tick along on their own. When somebody experiences trauma, those things are even impacted, meaning that people struggle with sleeping. Sometimes they wet the bed. Sometimes they don't have a good pulse on when they're hungry or full. And that is because the body's own self-regulatory system is jarred when something unexpected happens. Now, let me double back and maybe I should define trauma first. Trauma is anything that happens to us that tips our sense of reality upside down. And so it has less to do with what one has experienced and more to do with what one internalizes about that experience. The best way I like to think about trauma or describe it is that a race car driver that expects to possibly be flipped is going to have a very different experience than a young mother in a minivan with four small children. If that car flips, one is prepared for and understands the nature of the work that they're doing as a race car driver, whereas the young mother with four small children is going to find that very same experience terrifying. And so the body internalizes something as traumatic when it no longer can make sense of the nature of its surroundings. And when somebody experiences perpetual trauma or ongoing trauma, which is often the case with prisoners and with criminals and also with normal everyday human beings in this world, what that means is that they experience something that tips their relational or psychological world upside down. And so somebody who, let's just move away from, I'm kind of comparing the difference between a criminal and like a normal Christian. Both of these parties of people make mistakes, and we're contending that they make mistakes and need healing, that they're not sinners that need judgment. And so if we were to move to the other parts of the brain, the second part of the brain is the emotional center of the brain. And that is something that develops as life goes on. And it is responsible for memory and for emotional regulation. And then the top part of the brain that's kind of up above the forehead is called the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex. It is responsible for all sorts of things. It's responsible for attuned communication, emotional regulation. It's responsible for response flexibility, empathy, insight, the regulation of fear. It's responsible for the development of intuition and our sense of morality. If human beings are nurtured well, their brains develop adequately and they have a strong and highly functioning frontal cortex. Most criminals and a lot of just normal human beings don't have the luxury of a calm, pain-free, violence-free, abuse-free environment. There's either psychological abuse, there's emotional abuse, there's physical abuse, there's sexual abuse. And even in our patriarchal LDS church, there is a lot of psychological, physical, emotional, and mental abuse that happens. And this is common in all settings of church-going and non-church-going people. Human beings experience the woundedness of mortality, which causes or sets them up to make mistakes, to make bad choices, to wound one another. And we call these things sins. So the question then becomes, do we deserve punishment for being sinners? Or do we deserve compassion for being wounded because life has set us on a trajectory over which in many cases we had no control? And the outcomes are almost inevitable based on the situations where we find ourselves, especially when we didn't have control or power in our own lives. Anything you want to add to that, Fiona, as we kind of talk about the nature of the brain and how neuroscience is proving that like the brain becomes impacted by life, and then that impacted brain loses its capacity to manage its fear, to regulate itself, impulse control goes away. And things like that happen, which causes us to become wounded or to commit crimes or to make mistakes. Thoughts on that, Fiona?
I think your thinking is right in line with a number of womanist and feminist theologians to date, who I think are really spearheading this sort of conversation in very important ways. All of them suggest, Flora Keshkegian, Serena Jones, Cynthia Hales, all of whom are my heroines, all suggest that trauma poses unique challenges, transforming the discourse about suffering, God, redemption, and theological anthropology in significant ways. And I really think it does. At the end of the day, we have to look at the God with whom we have grown up and ask ourselves, well, would we like to be in the same room with him? Would we be able to have a conversation with him or her? Would we be able to share a drink together? Cold lemonade on a hot day? And the answer to all of those questions is no, we would not. We would be terrified. And so what I'm seeing now among a lot of theologians, and Shelley Rambo is articulating it most clearly, I think, I view persons as more vulnerable and the earth more wounded than I did before. I have come to believe that we are more connected in ways that we cannot account for and constituted by much that we do not know. Trauma is that which does not go away. It persists in symptoms that live on communities, and we see that especially trauma studies actually started with the realization that second generation children of the Holocaust, of Holocaust survivors, were in exactly the same situation. So what it is that they have done, but it isn't, it was the trauma from the parents coming down, and it does persist through generations with really deleterious consequences to mental health, physical health, even education. So she says it persists in symptoms that live on in communities and the layers of violence that constitute present ways of relating. There is a public uneasiness with trauma and a push to move beyond it. And whereas she is saying, no, we need to stay with it, we need to hold it, we need to value the person who is experiencing it, and whatever we do, do not do anything to devalue that experience. But I'm feeling that this is also entering into theological discourse. I think of Richard Rohr, particularly, he comes to mind. But when I read his daily notes, you sense that this person and a number of others, there are quite a few others, there's a growing movement of moving away from this idea of sin and punishment to woundedness and trauma. I think it's almost a global movement, and it's very, very exciting. In fact, philosopher Susan Bryson refers to life in the aftermath of trauma as a spectral existence. Death haunts life. The challenge for the community in which the trauma victim remains is for both to forge a path of healing despite its difficulties and complexities. What I love about this, of course, is now it becomes the idea of encompassing that person as families, as communities, to provide space for healing. And I think that particularly in religious traditions, that's vastly important, because the way one responds to somebody who has injured themselves, perhaps seriously, or been injured, tends to be to push away, like go elsewhere and then find your healing, find your sense of balance, and then return. Whereas I feel that there is this almost global recognition of coming, of not letting that person be on her own, bringing her into the community, loving her for as long as it takes for her to recover from what awful thing has happened. And I think we are on the cusp of a really beautiful global religious system, because it's not just Christians, it's people all over the world understanding that we are traumatized, understanding that there is only kindness that can help towards healing. And so for me, I'm just, my eyes are on Zion. I do feel that the world community will be able to grow together in such a way as to be able to create a united Zion, a universal Zion. So that is my hope, where the world is caught up in fire, and of course, fire being the dominant symbol of the Holy Spirit. My sense is, no, God knows that we are inherently good, and he's trying to help us all, help each other bring out that goodness and that beautiful beauty, so that we may build a community where people feel safe and loved, and which the Spirit can dwell.
I think what I'm picking up on that you're teaching me as we are unpacking this beautiful topic, Fiona, is that all of us rather than being criminal in some way, whether it be a sinful criminal that, you know, breaks a law of God, or a criminal, a traditional criminal who breaks the law of the land, that all of us are wounded. And that trauma, to a greater or less degree, is part of the human condition. You also brought up the really important point that trauma is transgenerational, and that there are those of us who have trauma embedded in our organs, and that the experience of trauma can be passed from generation to generation. Now, this is true of Holocaust survivors and their children and grandchildren down to 2 and 3 and 4 generations, which is in fact precisely what Fiona picked up on in her reading of the Old Testament, that it's not that the sins of the children or the sins of the fathers are blamed on the children, but it's the impact of what it means to be human that is experienced in the bodies and the nervous systems of children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren through many generations. I personally, Fiona, when you and I were talking about this offline a little while ago, it occurred to me that this also is, of course, relevant to our own Mormon people, those of us who have multiple generations of Mormon pioneer stock, right? Those of us who have multiple generations of Mormon heritage, that we are also a few generations from persecution and from a lot of anxiety and from a lot of need to manage anxiety with perhaps a high degree of tribalism and the desire for us to feel like we are extra special in God's eyes to protect us from fear and danger. And so the idea of transgenerational trauma courses through the blood of many of us heritage members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and causes us in some ways to make choices or to believe in certain ways that estrange us from others because we're scared. Mm-hmm. So rather than thinking of ourselves and others of God's children as bad or as inherently needing to be forgiven, what you're trying to propose here is that we are wounded in need of healing. Now, can we shift our conversation just a little bit over to some of the problems with our atonement theology that make it challenging or that make things actually worse for us? I'm thinking specifically, Fiona, about the emphasis on a bloody and violent crucifixion, and how I'm circling us back to your idea of, like, many of us have been raised on a mean and angry Father God and a violent Jesus, or at least a Jesus who was violently killed to protect us from a mean and angry God. I want to just read this quote and have you comment on it, if I may, because what we're talking about is the need to reform atonement theology so that we can recognize the woundedness of all of us. This is in your article. You say this: the image of God the Father demanding and carrying out the suffering and death of his own son has sustained a culture of abuse and led to the abandonment of victims of abuse and of oppression. Until this image is shattered, it will be impossible to create a just society. Close quote. This is Joanne Carlson Brown and Rebecca Parker. What I want you to comment on, Fiona, is that this quote here to me seems to be a beautiful place that links atonement theology with the criminal justice system, meaning that until we can reimagine a new kind of Father God and a new way of looking at atonement, we will not live in a just society, because our society will continue to look at a bloody death of an innocent and use that as justification for further violence as humans, one against another.
No, I absolutely agree. We are very broken as a religious tradition, as are many other Western Christian traditions, and this idea that there is a violent, wrathful God. And I see the American prison system in particular, because when I'm looking at other ways of confinement, ours seems to be particularly draconian. Essentially, people are sent to prison to be punished. Going to prison is not the punishment. It's the punishment that awaits you in prison. It's a debacle, really. It's I think it is a travesty of human justice to put so many people in uninhabitable quarters and have them live together with barely seeing the light of day, or in danger because so many of them are wounded that they can be harmful to each other. Rather, it's certainly not a place where people would say grace walks. And so I think for us as members of the church and members of the Christian religion in particular, it is incumbent upon us, I think, to go back to the original Christians in the East. The crucifixion was nothing to them. It just happened to be a mode of execution that the Romans used. If Christ had been in medieval Europe, he would have been hung, drawn, and quartered, or burned slowly. I'm not sure which is more painful, but we tend to focus on the crucifixion probably because of the blood. But in the early church, crucifixion was just a way to get to heaven. God needed to die and rise again to show us that we were here on earth for this thing, the passage through life with its turmoils and its tribulations, and then death, but then the promise of resurrection, a new life to come. And so this idea of crucifixion was nowhere apparent in the early Christian vocabulary or in their meetings. It was the sanctification of the bread of eternal life. And we've lost that drastically. And I'm not feeling it emphasized very much in our faith tradition either.
Can I read a little section from your article here? You say, or you're quoting somebody by the name of Winters.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you say: for many early Christians, incarnation and resurrection formed the base for the incipient gospel message. Death simply provided the bridge between the two. It was the Western church, not the Eastern, that emphasized the universal death in Adam over and against the universal life of Christ. Winter argues convincingly that the original atonement narrative, as propounded by the Greek church fathers, had been distorted by an almost exclusive connection between the crucifixion and the atonement. Close quote. So what I want to just emphasize or heighten, which you've already talked about, Fiona, is what we did is here in the West, we grabbed onto this Western Augustinian theology of death and blood and sacrifice and the need for him to suffer and the need for us to feel like he suffered. And what I'm hearing you say is that that is a complete and utter distortion of what the Eastern fathers taught us, which was because Jesus loved us, he would love us all the way to the death and become resurrected. But it really did not have to do with the mode of death. It's more symbolic of how much he loved us. And it needed not have anything to do with suffering of an innocent or blood. And we have taken that as a modern Christian nation, and we have completely warped it to actually justify the bad behavior of punishing others that we feel are guilty, rather than looking at Jesus Christ and the atonement as something that should teach us not the need to punish, but the need for infinite love and mercy. Am I capturing that right, Fiona?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you are. And I think we mentioned this before, that Western theology was predicated on Roman law. I mean, it was law, and it's still there. We still have it. You know, things need to be, if you do something, you need to pay it back. And it's the whole idea of having to pay for something that you have done wrong, or like returning the bread you have stolen. But the sin aspect of it is much more emphasized when it is just a loaf of bread. But we know that in Victorian England, you could be sent to Australia, lose your family for stealing a loaf of bread. So it's almost as though this idea of justice and retribution has dehumanized us, in a sense, where we have lost even the capacity to feel badly for someone who has been hurt, or who has or hurt themselves, done something which is wrong. We tend to take a step away rather than a step forward as though that transgression might be a sin and contagious. It's very, very troubling. I do see hope. I am seeing hope in various other Christian traditions as they're forging a way to more ecumenical, more inclusive of different religious traditions, particularly Christian traditions. And I think as a nation, we have fallen behind. It could very well, because part of it could be because we're so very isolated. I mean, we're just one big great island in the middle of a great big sea, and we border two countries. But we don't have that experience really of exchanging ideas with those who come from completely different cultures.
Hi everyone, I'm Mary, Valerie's assistant, here with a question. Have you become a Friday subscriber yet? If not, let me take 30 seconds to tell you why it's a good idea. Subscribers don't just get double the content each week. You also get perks like early access to our classes, special discounts, and the chance to participate in exclusive Q&A sessions. Friday subscribers, they get some pretty good stuff, but more than that, you help keep the Latter-day Struggles conversation going. So subscribe today. Click the link in today's show notes, and thank you for supporting Valerie and her work. Here's what's coming up on this Friday's episode.
I don't think the gospel of Jesus Christ really has anything to do with sin, salvation, and punishment, but everything to do with woundedness and healing. And I really do believe that our whole purpose as members of the Church of Jesus Christ is to build a global Zion. And I think if we start seeing people in these terms, we will have much greater influence and power to bring that a reality. And I'm not talking about an LDS Zion. I always think much bigger, very grandiose ideas of humanity. I'm talking about a global Zion. When the Lord comes, we will all fall on our feet in recognition that this man is the healer of our wounds and the world's wounds. And I see us all there, and then people will exclaim, "But I knew you as Buddha, or I knew you as Allah, but you are also Jesus." And so Zion has to be universal. There is a mother in heaven. Yes, she is the queen, and one of her names is wisdom, and it's right here in the Book of Mormon. I'm thinking that the Book of Mormon is essentially a feminine divine text, which is what I'm working on right now. I'm with you. It's like, really? Our tiny little church? That's it? But there are so many people all over the globe involved in these things every single day. We will not create Zion on our own. It's not possible. A global Zion needs to be created by everybody who is living on the earth. And millions of people are doing exactly that.
Let me ask you a question, if I may, Fiona. I'm thinking about how the Western Atonement theology created the criminal justice system. And so there's very much a connection between church and state here. And that it comes from retributive justice, the penal substitution theory, which created the prison systems. And one thing that I see as woven through both of them is the concept of motivation by shame.
I think that's brilliant.
What say you about that, as far as how they both are there and how ineffective they both are and how wounding they are?
You're absolutely right. It is shame. I'm looking in our religious tradition, and I'm not sure that isn't part of how we try to correct what we see as stepping out of the religious tradition. You know, I wonder, you know, if one is sitting on an airplane, for example, and one notices that a woman in your ward who hasn't realized you were there is drinking a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or even having a glass of wine, what would our immediate thoughts be? Would they be, "Oh, I like the fact that she feels that, you know, the word of wisdom is something that you keep generally, but not religiously, or would we look at her and condemn her for drinking her cup of tea or her glass of wine or whatever? And I'm speaking about myself here as well. I'm not sure that I wouldn't do the same thing. And it's like, what is that in us that makes us feel that any slight deviation from the norm is going to bring catastrophic damage on our heads? I think it has to do with shame. So how would she respond if she looked over at me and saw me there? It would be shame. And why should she feel like this? Why should she feel shame or he feel shame? It's because we've created this really almost a prison, actually. Oh, yeah, in our faith community, where people are to be rebuked and punished. And we punish by not allowing people to partake of the sacrament, or we actually move them right out. We excommunicate and push them right out of the church. And the church is the body in which they would receive the most healing. Those are very disconcerting, that we do that sort of thing. And that I think we have enough of the gospel of Jesus Christ to recognize that that is not what Christ would ever have done.
No. I thank you for your thoughts. And you have my mind spinning as well, because I'm thinking about the way the criminal justice system shames people is by dehumanizing them in prison, which is exactly what you were saying a minute ago, which is prison itself isn't the punishment. It's what happens in prison that strips people of their actual humanity. And just to stay with your point from a minute ago, excommunication is the shunning and shaming and casting people out of their communities. It's very similar to the casting out of solitary confinement in prison, in jail. And then the other thing that you had me thinking about, that where there's this sort of the strand of shame running through this, that I believe is, it's Augustinian. It's all about punishment and warlords and suffering and making sure people really feel bad about themselves. And so if somebody has some sort of a struggle, according to the teachings of the church, even if this is just a minor struggle, what do? They ban you from the temple and sacred ceremonies that are important for the bonding of family rituals. They ban you from the sacrament, which is a public ordinance. And I don't know that the intent is there. I dare say it's not there, but it is in fact a means by which people are publicly shamed and dehumanized.
Right. And punished.
Yes.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a cause for great concern, because as I understand our theology, it is all embracing.
Yes.
We want to embrace the world. At least I think we are assuming that the gospel of Jesus Christ is going to be carried into all the world. But if it has those impediments with them, I'm not sure how many will feel that they're being completely embraced. If there is that concern or that fear or that possibility that you would be sent away, that you would be rejected eventually. And that has that in and of itself is massively trauma inducing.
It is, because I think what I feel so passionately about is that the gospel of Jesus Christ is interested in expanding people's capacity to love, to receive, to accept, to embrace not only the generally accepted ways of being Christian or being human, but it's to accept the journeys that each other goes on, that their own ability to evolve and grow and make mistakes and gather themselves up and be beloved throughout the entire process. And I think that's what I hear in what you talk to us about in terms of the Eastern Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
That life is an education. The Western Fathers is, no, this is a big deal. This is serious. You could be punished. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just thinking, as you and I are talking about this, is that it occurs to me at how important it would be for our churches, ours included, LDS and surrounding evangelical, the Catholic Church here in the United States, do they know how much they have been influenced by John Calvin and by the Western Fathers that teaches a very, very frightening, scary God and a very, very frightening, scary mortality that makes making a mistake incredibly high risk, scary, isolating, and damning? It's a big deal, I think.
Oh, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. And we, what happens is that we live in fear. It forces one to live in fear because you're not sure of your place in the community. Can you rely on your community to be by you through thick and thin, whatever it is, or will you be shunned and punished? And again, you're just going back to Christ. He never shunned anyone. And what hurts me a little is to think that there would be so many people encouraging him from the Christian tradition to stone the woman, to kill the woman, because she deserved it. She broke a commandment and she must pay the penalty for it. That is what worries me the most, is how far we have come to image something that we have been taught in the scriptures to think, oh, this is Christ's great compassion and his great healing. And it is such that he can forgive sin, but he only can. And it's not even necessary for us to forgive sin. And that is really frightening.
One last thing I want to mention before we tackle our final topic, which is a little bit less depressing than what we're talking about right now, but this is still depressing. This one is, I'm interested in what you said in your article where you were talking about a three-tour U.S. veteran who emphasized the importance of what we're talking about, which is, well, hold on, let me go back. This scholar Rambo says this: trauma has not yet been adequately addressed either in our homes, our churches, or our religious communities. And then you emphasize this by quoting three-tour U.S. war veteran who had to have gone through a great deal of trauma because war is always traumatic. He says this: his deepest experiences remained untouched by the practices and teachings of his Christian faith. They were met with theological silence. Now, close quote. Now, what you and I are really talking about here, Fiona, is that there is a deficit, not just in, we're not just kind of talking, a lot of what we've been talking about has not been LDS specific. And yet at the same time, we are also encased in a larger religious system inside of a country that is very much dictated by our founding fathers who came across the ocean, brought with them their Calvinist ideas, and created a country based on the beliefs of Roman law. And that was infiltrated both in the religious systems that influenced our early church origins, right? In New York, you know, in the 1830s, it influenced the growth and development of the many, many church systems that are here in the United States, and it influenced, of course, the criminal justice system. And the whole point that we're trying to make here is that both of these things are hurting us. So we are both hurt because at church, I think we see God as a liege lord or someone who is mean and frightening. And then, of course, we see this also elsewhere in the criminal justice system, where everything is about the breaking of the law and the need to feel that we need to be punished. Okay. And that's what this gentleman is talking about, which is his own pain and suffering, his own trauma is met with theological silence. This isn't even somebody who's a criminal. This is someone who has just lived a life and has felt the wounds of his own military experience. So as we finish up today, Fiona, I would love to talk, to have us talk a little bit about how we can recover the atonement theology that we believe is still existent here in the church. But more specifically, we're going to go more granular and talk about the seeds of good atonement theology in our fourth and final episode of this series. But today we're going to just talk a little bit more about how can we disentangle Christianity from its Augustinian influences? Because in your article, you close by saying that the first thing that we can do to reclaim healing atonement theology is look at the language that we use. And you actually have an entire book about this. Why don't we start by just giving a little bit of an overview for anyone who listens to this podcast who perhaps has not read your book. I don't know, is it you or you and Terrell that wrote All Things New?
Oh, yeah, we both did.
Okay. So talk to us about All Things New, because this really is a relevant topic in terms of healing the very problem that we have been unpacking in these last few episodes.
Yes. No, thank you. Vocabulary, as we've been speaking about, is incredibly powerful. And Terrell and I thought, well, the vocabulary we are using is not actually reflecting the gospel of Jesus Christ. So this idea of guilt and sin and time out, they were formulated in a very different era with very different sensibilities about God and humanity, where God was sovereign. And we are vassals, and and he is our liege lord. What we discovered, though, that we, in order to expand our ability to love each other and to love ourselves, is to recognize that the vocabulary we have been using, which we have inherited from Christianity, Calvinist Christianity to be precise, does not work with the gospel we are admonishing. So, for example, in Mosiah, we have Christ coming with his wounds, and they are open because we know that, I think it was Thomas who put his hand in the wounds of the Savior. So he is both resurrected, but the wounds are still there. And what he is promising is that my wounds will heal you, come to me. And I think as soon as the tradition is changed in such a way that we are seeing God as all goodness and all beauty, that he is anxiously awaiting the return of each one of his children or their children, and that they are working, struggling to bring their children together. This was given to me a while ago. I thought to read it, but then I thought maybe not. But I'd like to read this so we can understand the love of God and what is not required of us, but what he is hoping that we will give, which does actually require a lot of negating of much of ourselves. Anyway, there is this beautiful woman called Reverend Betsy Parker. She happened to be in New York on September 11. And they were now called, those who were closest to the epicenter were called to come and help. There were prayers being offered the entire time, 24 hours a day, by various groups, but particularly by the Jewish tradition. There would always be one 24 hours a day, and it went on for at least 9 months. I would love to share with you what could be described as a poem that has resonated with me since the time I read this. And it was given at what is called the Pit in New York City just after the Twin Towers fell. And the place into which they fell was called the Pit. But she remembers, as I remember, it was about the time when you went down early one morning and heard the sound. What time was it? She replies, well, I think you're referring to is the sound of weeping. Yes, but it was much earlier than that. The Shemarah had not even started up the first time I heard the weeping. It was very shortly after the attack, that was the first time I heard it. It took me all day to get up to the end site because so many people were there. So it sometimes took them 8 hours to get through the crowds, the mourners, the parents, the families. And I heard something. It was a deep, very frightening, deep moaning sound as I walked through Memorial Park. And because I'd never heard it before, you'd think I didn't know what it was, but I did know. I knew that it was God weeping. She was asked why. He said, well, my sense that is that it was because those whom he loved the dearest had been ravaged and hated and destroyed by those whom he loved the dearest. I think we are not understanding, at least I know in my life, the capacity, the infinite capacity of God to love. And there is no point in our life where we should feel ashamed or unworthy of not coming to him, because his arms are always open in an embrace to heal us and to comfort us. And it was understanding the depth, and it was this wording, the depth of itself. And she wasn't the only one who heard it. A number of people heard that weeping and commented on it. They all recognized, and everybody who heard it, whether they were Muslim or Jewish or Christian, recognized that it was God weeping. And so for me, I think the God who weeps has more power than a powerful God would have, because when he opens his arms, we know that we can run into, and whoever we are, whatever we are done, we will be embraced by absolute love. I think it's our inability to feel that we are deserving, in large part because of the Christian tradition we've inherited, or that somehow we have to pay for the privilege. And we see that a lot in our own religious tradition. But for me, it was everybody, Muslim, Jews, anybody, everybody who was there heard that was God and that they were his children, all of them. And that has had a massive impact on my life and the way I see myself in my relationship to God, but also in the way I pray and hope we all will. There is no one that is unworthy. No one that is unworthy to be in that presence of absolute divine love.
Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful poem or that beautiful story with us, Fiona. What I was hoping you were going to say, and I didn't really know what to expect from what you were saying, but that God was weeping, that their children were equally beloved and that their children were hurting each other, and that God's children, they were wounded, we are wounded, and that we all need mercy. And so I think that's what we're trying to communicate and articulate here in this series, is that what happens as history unfolds is that we lose sight of our identity as children of God, who are much less than perfect, but we are always infinitely lovable, and that there is an atonement theology that can uphold this beautiful truth, whether it be a Latter-day Saint on a Sunday morning or a criminal in jail. We are all beloved, we are all wounded, and we all need grace, and we all need healing. So let's go ahead and close this episode up. We have one more episode left in this series where Fiona is going to actually talk to us about, I can't wait to hear this. This is very exciting for me. We are going to be unpacking Fiona's research on how the theology here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has some beautiful contributions to good, solid Christian theology that will help us feel as if we can heal. I am just so grateful for the chance that we had to talk today, Fiona, about this beautiful topic of how modern neuroscience is helping us better understand a good, solid, healing version of atonement theology. I think it's beautiful that modern science has continued in a multitude of different ways to teach us how to see God as good and loving and universally loving each of their children. And I think it's just beautiful that you and I have had this conversation. And next conversation that we're going to be having is Fiona is going to talk us through how our own Latter-day Saint theology has the seeds of good atonement theology. And I can't wait to learn more about that. So for those of you who have enjoyed this episode, I would invite you to please share this far and wide. For those of you who subscribe to this podcast, and for those of you who can support or want to support anything that I offer you, go on to latterdaystruggles.com where you can find workshops, classes, you can join one of my support groups, and please make a rating and review of this podcast if this is something that has been meaningful to you and is helping you in your faith expansion journey. So thank you so much for being here with me today, Fiona.
Thank you. Lovely to see you, Val.
It's always fun to be with you too. And we will see all of you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Latter-day Struggles podcast. Your support and listenership is extremely valuable to us. Please make Valerie's day completely awesome by leaving a 5-star rating and review. If you want to stay in the loop, head to our website and sign up to join our email list. Valerie is always creating new and amazing resources for us, such as monthly live webinars, support groups, classes, one-on-one consultations, and more. Check out all the links and resources in the show notes or visit our website at latterdaystruggles.com. Finally, Latter-day Struggles is a proud member of the Dialogue Podcasting Network, a foundation devoted to the discussion of varying viewpoints within the Latter-day Saint community since 1966. Thanks. We'll see you next time.
Dialogue Podcast Network.